Hey, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions, and it is we're going out on the Facebook pages of KBOO Community Radio and the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, as well as my own Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch pages. And it goes up as a podcast afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And I am very happy to be spending the hour with old friend and New York-based musician and photographer Bev Grant, who has who's more known to many particularly in certain circles as a topical songwriter for the past 50 years or so. But there was a period of 4 years where she was taking a whole lot of amazing photographs. And we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about music and photography and politics, I believe, over the next hour. Bev, it's great to have you the show. And I mean, looking around at these photos, it's just amazing. The photos are all from 68 to 72. This collection on BevGrantPhotography.com, and we'll look at some of those as we go. But it's just an amazing collection of photos, and it just brings you to the period. And I mean, for me, I was only born around then, but it just brings you right. It's amazing how a photo can just do that, like a smell, I imagine, except you can't smell the photos, but it has that kind of power to it, doesn't it, when you see those photos yourself. And you were saying you don't remember taking a lot of those photos, actually.
Right. So it was when I started digitizing them back in 2017, it was like, oh my God, I mean, I did have contact sheets, but I couldn't afford to print back in the day, like I was doing it for, I was doing it as an activist, and I was taking photos for Liberation News Service, which is like a press service for the underground newspapers that were happening then, and for New York Newsreel, which was a political documentary filmmaking group that I joined. Both of these started for me in 67. And, it was like that was just my arm. I learned how to take photos. I had a camera, that was given to me. And I had friends from these organizations I was with, actually, who trained me, showed me how to use a light meter, talked about how to frame a photo. And I mean, I think I must have had some, talent that was latent, and at least in enabling me to frame an image, because I was artistic as a kid, so there was all of that stuff. I won't belie that there was more than just somebody showing me how to shoot, but
definitely
that's how it felt. I never took it seriously as an art form, I wouldn't say. I mean, I cared about how it looked, and there was an aesthetic there that I was looking for, but so much of it was just on the fly, Oh, I'm going to this demonstration, or I'm going to go visit the Panther office, or the Young Lords, or as part of my early feminism, my involvement in the women's movement, the Miss America Beauty Pageant, and which women's,
Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. Is that which?
When that was coined. It was really spur of the moment. And Peggy Dobbins, who is attributed to, I mean, the witch is kind of her baby. She was one of my sisters in the women's movement, and one of the women who got busted, or the only woman who got busted at the Miss America Beauty Pageant for emitting a toxic odor.
Because what?
We had some of us had got press passes. I did, and another woman from Newsreel, and another photographer. The three of us got press passes, and we sat in the with the press. But Peggy bought a ticket. She sat in the back of the theater, and a couple other women were up in the balcony with a banner that they put over. But we all sort of had a signal, and Peggy had armed us with these atomizers full of Tony Home Permanent Solution. And that was the toxic odor.
Tony Home Permanent Solution. What is that?
that was, well, when I was a kid, I used to get Tony Home Permanents all the time. My mom.
Oh, that's to make your hair all frizzy.
Or curly. Yeah. Right. And it smelled, you know, really nasty. So, you know, Peggy, they were the sponsor of the Miss America Beauty Pageant.
That's Peggy perfect.
Peggy is brilliant. You should have her on sometime. So we all had these atomizers, and she set hers off and got caught. And Miriam Boxer, who was one of the other photographers, she's a very nervous person. She's unscrewing hers, and she squirted me with it by accident. So we got in the wind right away, you know, and did not get busted. And the women in the balcony put the banner over that said Women's Liberation. So there was all these things going on. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, so much art and theater and antics involved.
Yeah. Exactly. But that's, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, probably.
Well, I mean, we're staying in the general ballpark of the period, so that's pretty good. By from this vantage point, 50 years later, it's kind of like, yeah. I mean, but the you know, when I was reading a book, Robert Fisk's book, The Great War for Civilization, about his career as a journalist, basically, and it was so interesting to me to note how often the stories revolved around getting a piece, getting some pictures out of a country, like, and you know, to the press service, like getting the pictures out of Afghanistan, across the borders, wherever they needed to go, so they'd eventually end up, you know, where they could actually get developed and put into a newspaper. And those kind of logistics, I know, even just like not that long ago, you know, before you could just directly upload your photos from your phone, I mean, there was a lot of these kinds of like challenging logistics involved with doing any kind of photography, right?
And exactly. I mean,
good stories come to mind.
Well, I processed my own film, you know, and it was kind of primitive. It was, you know, you have to do it in complete darkness. And there was nowhere in my apartment. I was living in a collective of newsreel members, and we had a dark room. There was nowhere where I could do that except a bag that you stick your arms in. And so you have this little container that's cylindric. How do you, cylindrical? Right. And you have a spool. And so you have to open up the film and you like spool it on by feel onto these things and then stick it in the, and pour the solution in and, you know, do whatever. I can't even remember. And then you like dry it and then you can print it. And we had a printer, but the cost of print paper was exorbitant, you know? So I would make contact sheets and I would show them to Liberation News Service or to Newsreel, and we'd mark which ones I should make a print of. And I have some of those old prints, and the funny thing is they're considered valuable. And I was not a great printer, but, you know, my publisher who runs the gallery where I first exhibited in 2018, you know, she can charge a lot of money for those prints, the archival prints. They're archival. Just their age makes them valuable, you know.
I bet. And then how rare they must be. So, I mean, not only, like, first of all, what strikes me is both the artistry of your photography, but the quality of the pictures, which is just, which, I mean, there must be so much fewer high quality photos from that period than there are from like the modern period, because everybody's got decent cameras in their pockets these days, I guess. But I mean, it seems like there's been, with both audio quality and picture quality, there's been this weird kind of trend over the decades where when we look at photos, like digital photos from 10 years ago, they're horrible. And so a lot of people maybe think of there's some kind of progress here, but actually, no, the stuff you were taking was, I mean, the quality of what we, I guess, call analog photography is just stunningly good.
Yeah, it is. And I don't consider mine as great as some of the people that were doing it back then. And you know what's really sad is, for example, Miriam, who I spoke about, who squirted me with the stuff, she was a really good photographer. And she lives in India now. And I got in touch with her maybe a year or two ago. And she lost everything that she had taken just in the process of moving around a lot. I was really fortunate to have settled in 1977 in my apartment where I live right now, you know.
Rent-controlled apartment in New York City. Exactly. A fantasy for so many people in the world dealing with the current rental market as it is outside of there.
Privileged. I feel so privileged, you know.
Oh, it's crazy.
Amazing. And I miss my neighbors. I miss the people that were forced out, you know. I mean, I helped build a community here, you know, that, you know, like during the blackout in 77, and I had just moved on the block, the Italian kids broke into the furniture store on the corner, and then they left, and the Black and Puerto Rican kids from the block went in and they got busted, you know. Now, I mean, I was still connected to Newsreel and the movement and new lawyers and stuff. And I started a defense committee and raised bail money. And for that, I was welcomed, you know, as a real member of this block. I helped plan block parties and unity days and stuff like that, you know. So it felt like in this context, I was a community organizer, you know. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, and I love it still. And I got so gifted back by the community. You know, one woman whose daughter I had gotten bailed out of jail took care, did my after school care for my daughter until she didn't need it anymore. You know, she insisted. She had a grandson who was going to the same school, so it was like part of her pickup anyway. But still. For a working mom, it was such a gift, you know. And for my daughter too, you know, to be there. Yeah. This woman had been everybody called her Nana, and she had been a nurse for Dr. Martin Luther King. Hmm. You know, so she had a history herself. You know, it was just that kind of stuff made this block so rich for me and helped me to understand, you know, how to be a young white woman. You know, I made mistakes. I did. I got the attention of the men, you know, and in some ways that was great because we did this block party and we built a stage and I had a van because I was in my band at the time, The Human Condition. And the guys would jump in and we'd go collect wood and we'd come back and they built the stage and stuff. But then I realized I didn't know the women. You know, and the women looked a little askance at me, you know, so I began to learn, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, how to blend in, you know, how to be part of. And
at that point that you're learning this particular lesson in that context, you had already very actively been a feminist for a long time, of the feminist movement. So that's what a fascinating lesson to be learning years into that process.
Exactly. But I treasured it because it, I have children of color, and it helped me in terms of understanding what I had to do as their mother, you know, to make their lives as conscious as possible. And I can't say that I was totally successful, you know.
None of us are, huh? That's not possible, I don't think.
I love the pictures you take of your kids, by the way. They're such beautiful children.
They're pretty photogenic.
They are.
But especially in a park, you know, just anybody. I think most of the photos I take are in parks, and it's kind of a lot harder to go wrong when the background are these beautiful trees and grass that we have in the parks around here.
And I want to tell people that I grew up in Portland, where you live.
Yeah, can you talk about did that relate in any particularly direct way to you getting into music and photography, or was that were your parents artists, or
my dad played piano, and I had two older sisters and a younger sister as well, and two younger brothers. There were six of us, but the two older sisters and I formed a trio when we were in Portland called the Miller Sisters, and we performed on some television shows, the Heck Harper show. We were kind of regulars on that for a while. That was a country western show. We were not country western singers. The only country western song we did was Tumbling Tumbleweeds. But we sang kind of pop songs, The Naughty Lady of Shady Lane and Pretty Girls Like a Melody. And I sang Elvis songs like Heartbreak Hotel and Blue Suede Shoes.
And where did you do this? What venue or what station?
We did it for the Shriners, and we did it for the Sisters of the Eastern Star. Those were the first kind of gigs we had.
Great.
And, we did it at state fairs and on TV, like I said. So, you know, it was like we were active for, I would say, I started around when I was 10 taking guitar lessons, and one of my sisters played lap steel, electric lap steel guitar, and the other played an upright Gibson electric bass. You know, I wish we had these instruments.
Wow. Do you still ever play with your sisters? Are they still playing?
They stopped. And I stopped for a while because my boyfriend, this is like in high school. I mean, I sang all the way through high school. But when I left high school and we started to live together pretty much right away, he was a jazz musician. And I felt inferior. I felt unworthy of jazz. And
right.
that was it. And I mean, amazingly, I got to see and meet so many incredible jazz musicians, you know, like.
Very humbling experience for anybody playing an instrument to meet really good jazz musicians. Like, okay, I really
well,
respect.
I put it down. I stopped, you know.
It's an easy reaction to have, right? Yeah.
Well, also, you know, you think about, there was no women's consciousness really around me, you know, and I had been this feisty kid. I was a tomboy. I was really into sports and, you know, and performing a lot. So I had this self-consciousness, and then adolescence happens, you know, and I was told in sixth grade, I couldn't play football anymore because I was a girl. And, you know, all these messages, these confusing messages about what you're really supposed to do, you know, and what should you be striving for? So I became a musician's old lady, and I learned to cook and iron and, you know, like keep the house and work and support the musician. Mm. You know, I always had a job, I was on unemployment 1 year because of and this was pre-consciousness, but I had a job where I was working for a vice president of an electronic company of some sort in New York when I'd moved here.
So and it was a legitimate enough job that you could actually get on unemployment. So
Exactly. But I got on it because the big boss, who was notorious for feeling up the girls in the office, you know, they would go in his office. I never had occasion to do that. They would go in his office, come out all disheveled. And it was just office knowledge that was happening. And one day he came up behind me in the main office where I worked, and I was at the filing cabinet. And he put his hands on me, and I said really loud, "Get your hands off of me." And I got fired the next day by my boss, who hated to fire me, but he was forced to. And the human resources person said, she was a woman, "Don't worry, you can apply for unemployment. I won't say you were fired," you know.
Mm.
So that's how I did that. So, you know, I still had a little bit of gumption, you know, but I didn't, I really expected my husband to be more of a man, you know, because I thought that was the problem. And I left him for more of a man.
So explain that. What was that process? What was that thinking? Like, what was he not doing that you thought he should be doing?
Well, there was this guy, this piano player. We lived on Washington Avenue in Brooklyn in a house with Don Cherry, who was a wonderful trumpet player, and Eddie Blackwell, drummer. They both play with Ornette Coleman, you know, and we were on the ground floor, and my husband, Mike, we had a piano, got friendly with a guy in the neighborhood named Gil Coggins, who was an old time jazz player, but kind of down and out. And he didn't have an instrument. So Mike invited him over to play, you know, whenever he wanted, but he would show up late at night, and I had to get up in the morning to go to work. And my bedroom was right next to the living room where the piano was. So Mike would never ask him to leave. And he would just kind of like yawn and make movements as if, you know, and Gil didn't pay any attention to it. And one day I said, Gil, all Mike's trying to say is, you should really go. We have to go to bed. He says, I'm waiting for him to say it. And that was like, you know, that blew me away and really pissed me off. And that was kind of where I guess I didn't have enough consciousness to, you know, to not blame Mike for that. You know, I shouldn't have blamed him for that, but I did. Mm-hmm. And later on, I apologized. Years later, when I got a little bit more conscious, and when he actually apologized to me, and I didn't know what he was talking about. But anyway.
You're like, well, trying to remember, like, no, actually, I'm the one that messed up there. You're like, you know, nice of you to apologize.
I did leave him, you know, for a really, a drummer who's really fantastic and who played with the top jazz people. But you know, and this is something I don't regret because of what I learned from it, what I learned from living with an African-American man and being in that, the different situations where that affected our relationship. You know, we were walking one night home from the Half Note, which was, Coltrane was playing there, and my boyfriend was sitting in, and we walked back. And there was some guy on the floor on the sidewalk, you know, it was late in the early in the morning. And I said, let's stop and see if he's okay. And he said, okay. So we stopped and the guy was drunk and he got up and he was white guy. And he started coming after us and, you know, followed us for two blocks and challenged my friend and they got into a fight. And at that point, I realized I couldn't yell for help. You know, because I would be thought of as the white guy's girlfriend because of that, you know. So that was kind of a, oh, you know, kind of white skin privilege moment in really, you know, awkward kind of thing. So this, all that stuff, you know, I mean, he was very controlling. One of the funniest things in retrospect is I was reading The Second Sex, you know. And I told him about it and he threw it out, you know. So I was like, I never finished reading it. I actually just got a copy from a friend.
God.
But I didn't, you know, I when I finally got out of that relationship is when I started to grow because I moved in by myself for the first time. And I had a really cool next door neighbor who ended up becoming my lover, but you know, that was kind of common. He was from Colombia, the country, and he was not the kind of guy I normally would have gone for. He was kind of more light and intellectual and fun. And, you know, we started going to demonstrations together. He had a camera and we started taking photos and, you know, I learned how, I found my youth again and my enthusiasm and, you know.
And what year was that, Bev?
That was 66.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
And this was in Portland.
No, still in Portland. This is in New York. This
in
is
New York.
All of this is happening.
It's all in New York. And but when did you, before you came to New York, you went to San Francisco?
Yeah, for a year. And then we, that was before we got married and my father had cut me off from my family because he said I was living in sin. So I was feeling a little depressed, you know, I gained a lot of weight. I was like, I was just going to work to support us, you know, and I didn't have a lot of, I had hardly any female friends. You know, so
and that common how I mean, among so many of the people you knew at that time, I imagine that experience of being cut off from your parents for living in sin was not that unusual, right? I mean, was that that wasn't unique for you, right?
There weren't so many people like me then, I think. You know, I mean, me and my boyfriend, who I later married, you know, like when we were 18, he brought me a book called Drugs and the Mind. So I read it and decided which drugs I was okay about taking, you know, and we experimented together. And so there was that kind of, oh, and also that was when birth control became available, which mm-hmm. I think confused me, because that to me was sexual freedom, right? And I think as I look back and think about who I was then, that's where I found my worth, you know, if men were attracted to me, you know, mm-hmm. and wanted to and desired me, you know. It's pretty sick when I think about it in retrospect, but it's true, you know. And that a lot was fueled by the being unafraid of getting pregnant. You know, I went on the pill right away in 1960 when it was really strong, you know, and really
and damaging.
Yeah. When I came off of it, I didn't have a period for a year and my womb had atrophied, you know, so it's like, but I didn't know all of that, you know, and mm-hmm. it gave me this freedom that was not especially, well, it was important, you know, it was important. But I think I, you know, it messed me up in terms of really finding what my freedom would be, you know, and that took the women's movement to really, to open my mind, to go through consciousness raising, which I encountered in 67.
The photo collection starts in 68, and it starts with, I mean, some of the first photos in the collection are from the women's movement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's, can we
sure
look at some of these? I have, let's see.
Go to the Jeanette Rankin. That was the first thing I photographed. That's that one right there on the right.
Yeah. Jeanette Rankin Brigade March on Washington.
Right. That was not organized by us, the women mm-hmm. in my women's group, but we did attend, and we attended it. This is Peggy Dobbins with uh-huh. a colander on her head, the one who got arrested at the Miss America Beauty
Pageant. The colander on her head. And so she is like an early sort of precursor to the Church of the Spaghetti Monster. I mean, this is you know, the outfit of any minister in the Church of the Spaghetti Monster. Well, is a colander on your head. Just, you know, I know there are people watching who know this. This is not something I'm just making up.
She was definitely into guerrilla theater, and so was Kathy Barrett, who's the other one. Kathy Barrett was part of a guerrilla theater group called the Pageant Players. And do you know Professor Louis?
Yeah.
Well, this was his girlfriend at the time. And that's when I met Professor Louis. He's my oldest friend. And his name is Victor Lewis. But anyway, they were in the Pageant Players together. And that's Florence Kennedy was a feminist, but also a civil rights attorney. Mm-hmm. And quite flamboyant and outspoken, you know. So.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
It's just the expressions on the faces of people is so precious, and it just somehow tells you so much about the period. I don't know.
Right. Well, they were like Women Strike for Peace and, you know, like middle of the road kind of anti-war people.
Right.
Well, then if you go to Miss America,
mm-hmm.
There we go, on the right again. If you go to the bottom, just scroll down to the bottom.
Mm.
Keep going. There. Mm. That's my small consciousness raising group coalesced with a bunch of other women and formed a group called New York Radical Women. And we met weekly, I think, in the SCEF office, the Southern Conference Educational Fund office. I think Ann Braden was involved with that, and they were doing support work for SNCC, for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and all the civil rights stuff that was going on. Basically a white organization, but definitely doing support work. And this is, we did a combination of consciousness raising in this group, as well as Kathy Amotnick, who was a member and was actually the office manager at SCEF, which is why we were meeting there. She came up with the idea of protesting the Miss America Beauty Pageant, just to point out one person here with her leg over her knee and the blonde hair. That's Carol Ann Jones. She was part of a group called Radio Free People. And they did kind of like podcasts, but on tape that they sent around to the different, they were syndicated. You know, they sent them to different radio stations, the college stations and the, you know, public right. access radio stations.
Yeah, that's great. And I love when you're talking about the Liberation News Wire and all that. I mean, these are basically, you're describing phenomena that should be very familiar to anybody in the internet age. It's just the analog versions of these same kinds of phenomena exactly. in terms of distributing content and all that. Exactly. It just involved a lot more stuffing envelopes.
Yes, it did. A little slower.
A lot slower, but I really miss those work parties when everybody, you know, I mean, not that I participated in that many of them, but I'm sure you did, where everybody's at that time, where you're spending all hours and hours together doing menial tasks like stuffing envelopes and stuff.
Well, I did a lot of that in my jobs too.
Yeah, know? Right. Right.
I had clerical jobs throughout my life. You know, I was well trained in high school. I did not go to college. I went for a few months. You know, I had a scholarship to Portland State, and I was studying, I was going to study Arab studies because I figured since I was from a mixed background of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, and I had this really good Israeli girlfriend who would talk to me about Israel, I figured, well, I could probably help, you know. Uh-huh. Why? But I thought that, well, that's why I'll take Arab studies. I'll learn Arabic, you know, and here I am, like, representative of both sides in a way. But I mean, I was a little bit naive.
And doing, when you talk about the work that you were doing with that group around, basically a lot of it centered around supporting the work that SNCC was doing. And I wonder,
well, but we didn't do that. Not the New York Radical Women was meeting in their office. That was not our work.
Oh, I see. I see. Got it.
Although it's important to note that many of the women who started the women's movement that I knew were civil rights workers who had come up. You know, it was when SNCC kind of purged the organization right. of whites, and they came back. And they had this organizing consciousness, you know, so they were good organizers and they did a lot to bring women together.
So. Yeah, I bet. And I wonder about those. I don't know if I'm just thinking out loud here, formulating questions on the fly here, but I've just in the past year where there's been so much going on that I wonder if when I'm thinking about that, the sort of dynamic of white people within a black led organization like that and those dynamics that were part of what you had to be dealing with in a big way on a fairly constant basis for a while there, that a lot of people are once again thinking about. And I don't have a particular question. I'm just wondering if you got any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that people misjudge some of what was going on then. You know, I mean, Newsreel had really, I would say, pretty close alignment with the, you know, the people of color movements, you know, that were going on. They saw us as allies, and we were their arm, their media arm in some ways, you know, particularly the Young Lords Party. They had a really, you know, Pablo Yoruba Guzman, who was their minister of information. He had read Marshall McLuhan, and he really saw the, you know, importance of media. And he embraced us. He really embraced us. That's Denise Oliver.
Mm-hmm. She was the Young Lords section here for anybody right. on the audio.
She was mm-hmm. African American, but she was part of the Young Lords Party. They had not just Puerto Ricans in their group. They had African American and Dominicans and, you know, all different ethnicities amongst the Latinx movement. And this is a march after Fred Hampton died, you know.
powerful photo. And also the way the flag in the photo in the foreground takes it kind of dominates like the image is really.
Something. And that's Denise right in the, you know, up above the star. And Richie Perez, who remained active for a long time, but died really young, is over on the right. They embraced us, you know, and it was interesting because one of the sisters who became Iris Morales, she became leadership in the organization later on. And me and two other filmmakers from Newsreel made a film about the Young Lords Party called
Sorry, I just lost you for a moment there. The film called what?
El Pueblo Se Levanta, which is distributed by Third World Newsreel, who antecedent of Newsreel. She said to me fairly recently, she said, if it hadn't been for me, Bev, you know, there would have been no women in the El Pueblo film. And they later gained leadership, but you know,
that says so much, doesn't it, about the what were the male photographers doing?
Yeah, I mean, it really demonstrates intersectionality to me, you know, and that we, you know, we did contribute to each other's consciousness, you know, like different issues maybe, but you know, like I learned so much working in Newsreel. I can't, you know, it taught me so much, not just about what was happening locally, but internationally. I mean, Richard Wright's daughter, Julia, came to us and asked us to help her edit a film about Mozambique and the struggle there. And it was like, there was this incredible scene of Samora Machel in the jungle or whatever it was, you know, with his guerrilla band. He was the first president of Mozambique, but he was a guerrilla fighter. He was, you know, in charge of the army. And I was so impressed because he's telling his soldiers, you know, when we go to this village, I want you to remember that these are your mothers. These are your daughters. These are your sisters. You know, you treat them as such, you know, and this is like, you know, from a whole nother universe. They don't have a women's movement there, you know, but there was that consciousness, you know, we didn't make it up, you know, it's like, it's been a struggle throughout history in different parts and takes different forms, you know, and that always stuck with me and made me, I guess, receptive and conscious and curious about what was going on other continents, you know. And so I've written songs about women in South Africa, soccer playing women. I've written a song about Kenya and a woman who established a village for women who had been raped by British soldiers and then it being considered their shame. You know, so all of this is connected for me, you know, and has influenced everything about my life, you know, how I look at the world. And you know, I sit here with tremendous privilege, you know, but I feel on my shoulders, I feel that weight, you know, that whatever I can do to help educate people, to bring people's problems. There's this thread on. I'm part of a group called People's Music Network for Songs of Freedom and Struggle, which started back in the 80s. And I joined pretty early on, and Pete Seeger was a big part of that, Charlie King. So, but there's a thread on it right now talking about, is it, you know, about this whole thing about culture. What is the word? Not assimilation, culture. Like taking somebody else's culture and
cultural appropriation.
I
saw that thread. I haven't read any of the messages, but I saw the subject coming up.
They were responding to a song, and I forget who wrote it. That's written in say it's about a Jamaican woman or a West Indian woman or something. It's written in the dialect of, you know, is that okay? I say no. You know, I mean, I think it's fine to use musical styles and appropriate, but I would never feel comfortable about singing in somebody else's dialect. You know, that I'll sing in Spanish, but that's Spanish.
Yeah, that's nice that you put it that way, because I was always trying to put it, I was trying to, you know, nail down what was it that made me uncomfortable, you know, and what is it that doesn't make me uncomfortable about these different kinds of ways of playing music from different cultures and around the world and all that. And that is it. That's it. You nailed it right there. That is, it's when you're, I mean, at least as far as the whole thing of hearing white people singing Caribbean music, it's not playing the music. It's singing in the dialogue. Why do they have to do that? What is the point there? Why not use their own accents?
It just makes me churn inside.
Yeah, me too. Me too. But I never was able to understand. I was never able to express exactly what it was that was making me churn. But because it's an emotional reaction, right? And you realize this is wrong. This is wrong. I can tell this is wrong. I can't, but I couldn't explain it. But now,
it feels like they're making fun of it in a way.
Yeah. Even if they're not, it's just like, why? Why the accent?
Yeah. All right, now we got that one.
So. Yeah, I'm glad we got that covered. And by the way, speaking of People's Music Network, there's going to be the PMN Summer Conference is happening online during the first weekend of June, and I'm sure we'll both be there, I think. I was just got an email about doing a workshop in it, so I'll probably be seeing you there on peoplesmusic.org, I think. And speaking of websites too, there's a GoFundMe page. If people look for Bev Grant Photography, it'll come right up, and where this book that of amazing photographs is dependent on a crowdfunding campaign being successful before it's going to become a physical book, I believe. So people should donate to that. If
getting close, it's getting close, but we could use some more money to help with the. You know, promotion and stuff like that, and get the final push out there. And I hope to be coming to Portland sometime in the fall.
Oh, great.
So I hope we can see each other.
I hope so. Yeah. When book tours are happening again, is that going to be a book tour?
I'm going to combine it with, you know, my family is out there still. I've got two sisters and a brother and zillions of nieces and nephews. In fact, some of them you may know. I mean, Michael Allen Harrison is a piano player who does a lot of charitable and wonderful work in Portland and is pretty well known. And Tom Grant, my brother-in-law, is a well-known jazz piano player in Portland. And Brian Harrison, another nephew, is a rock and roller, kind of, although I think he's going into other branches as well. So it's wonderful when I go out there, I hang out and play music with them as well, which is fun. But let's show a few more photos.
Should we show some more photos?
Yeah.
I wanted to also ask about when you were mentioning about being privileged, and it just occurs to me that, you know, so much of this privilege has to do with the luck of place and time, and like the fact that, like, I mean, when I think about the housing crisis of today, New York still has rent control for people living in buildings that were built before 1947.
Rent control is only happening for people who already have it. You know, it's going to phase out. I'm rent
exactly.
Stabilized. I'm rent stabilized, which means practically, your rent goes up at the end of each lease based on an amount that's determined by a special board of people. You know, so during the pandemic, it didn't go up at all for most people, but when it goes up for me, I don't get that increase in the rent that I have to pay. The state subsidizes the rest of what the increase is in my landlord's taxes. So, you know, I've been flat out, you know, with my $600 and some rent for a 4-room apartment for years. you know, since I turned 65.
And then what have you seen? When did the neighborhood start changing as a result of all the rents going up for everybody else? And like, what has that transformation looked like?
Well, my block was predominantly Black and Puerto Rican. Okay. And mm-hmm. I moved here in 77, sometime in the late 80s, I guess, early 90s, it started to change. And it, you know, it was partially that the rents went up, but it was more that the speculators were coming around trying mm-hmm. to buy properties. And there were some, you know, there were two Puerto Rican families, and they were somewhat connected familiarly. And they each sold their homes. I think they probably got about $70,000 for them, right? Well, those homes have now been renovated very quickly and go for over $1 million, you know, maybe up to three. And, you know, I think back because I was on welfare at the time when this was happening because I'd had a kid and I decided to take advantage of what our parents fought for. You know,
yeah, welfare. People will be like, what's that? You know, this is now for the first time in decades, there's going to be this tax, you know, money coming in for those of us who have children. It's like, I can't believe it. I'll believe it when I see it coming into the bank. Yeah. It's going to start next
Medicaid. I've stayed on it mostly for the Medicaid because, you know, free. And so I was around the block a lot. And I did, like I said, I did a lot of organizing on the block, but I was also, you know, I had my band Human Condition, and that also had an effect on me politically because we were such a multinational band starting in the 80s. You know, we had like Brazilian, Nicaraguan, African-American, Puerto Rican, Haitian. I mean, we had all nationalities. Somebody from Zimbabwe, you know, we sang in all these different languages, talking about doing songs from other cultures, you
That's
know.
Great.
I learned to sing in Creole. I learned to sing in Spanish as well as English. And, you know, we paid tribute to all of our different backgrounds, you know, and the different struggles of the countries where people came from. And that was amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And the experience of playing for audiences that are from the kind of like who have had the experiences that you're singing about.
Exactly.
And then seeing how they react to that.
That's exactly.
It's better than any review you can ever get, isn't it?
Yeah. We went to El Salvador in 88. Which was the period when the Arena Party was coming in and the Social Democrats were going out. So it was this sort of bubble, you know, and the FMLN, together with the university, organized this huge Nueva Canción festival and got in touch with us and invited us to come there. Uh-huh. And only four of us went because pretty much everybody else was a little bit frightened about going. But we went. And, you know, we had some pretty hairy experiences, but it really felt, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, you know? And
that's right in the midst of the civil war in El Salvador, a year before the November offensive of 1989.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was rubble. There were bridges that had blown out. We went out to a town called San Miguel. There was just maybe four or five acts that traveled there. The whole group itself was maybe 10 to 12 different, you know, acts from different countries in Latin America and Central America and U.S. Holly Near was on that tour, but she didn't come to San Miguel with us. And we got there and they were setting up a stage in the plaza, the town plaza, which is center of town, always has this, you know, square kind of thing. And then they took us to this motel, which consisted of kind of stucco buildings without glass in the windows, just plain cutouts for windows, dirt floor, and a bowl that you washed yourself with water, right? And we heard after we'd gotten there that the army had come in and taken down the stage. And so it got really a little scary. and let WBAI know and public broadcasting know, and the university was involved. They got on the air, and so they decided they'd bring us back to San Salvador, but could we swing by the stage area to let the people who had come in from all over the countryside for this concert, not for us. There was a very famous Mexican singer who they had come to see, right? But they...
Who was that? Do you remember?
God, I'd have to run in the other room. I can't remember her name.
That's okay.
Maybe it'll come. But anyway, so we got to the square, and it was full. I mean, hundreds, thousands of people. And the guide said, well, look, we think it's probably safe for you to play because the sound man was able to set the sound up. Are you willing to do that? And so we said, sure, you know. And so we get up on stage, and just as we're starting to sing this song, Que Viva El Salvador, a helicopter comes down, like treetop level.
Whoa.
Machine gun sticking out of the door.
Oh, wow.
But we did it. And they didn't shoot us. And they checked under the vans that we were traveling in to make sure there were no bombs, you know, before we went back to the motel. But that was the kind of thing. We got checked all the way in and all the way back. We got stopped by the military. And Ubaka Hill, who was with us, she's an African-American, wonderful percussionist, has long dreads, right? And the people along the way, when we would stop and they would come up and try to sell us things, you know, mangoes or whatever they had, they were fascinated with her hair. They wanted to touch it, you know, and I was like feeling so queasy for her, you know, and she was so gracious, you know. She had a lot of self-confidence, you know, to be able to not feel attacked by that, and she snipped off a piece.
Oh.
And gave it to them. You know, it was just amazing. It was
beautiful.
Yeah.
What a reaction. That's like, I've never even heard of somebody doing that. I mean, that is just,
presence. These were, you know, people from the country, and, you know, that wasn't their experience. That was nothing they'd ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I traveled around Cuba with a translucent blonde, and and she was totally fine. I mean, she got a lot of attention for. I mean, it was all very nice, not disrespectful attention, but generally, right. it was definitely like, you know, you don't see translucent, that kind of Iceland kind of blonde. You don't see that.
Yeah.
But did you? That experience with the helicopter, they probably couldn't hear anything that was going on the stage from the helicopter. But my first thought as I hear that story is you might have been thinking, oh, I wish I was singing in English at the time. You know what I mean? Like, because, like, you know, take advantage of this and make sure they know there are foreigners here. There are white foreigners here who sing English songs, you know, because I'm sure you were in that situation on many occasions where you're not sure how bad things could have gotten if not for the presence of white people around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Odd. So, do you recall any particular situations like that? I mean, I can off the top of my head recall many, but did any come to mind where you thought this could be good? This is probably going to be going very differently if we weren't right here at this time.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. You know, like I've been really lucky in my life. You know, like I've been in many different situations where it could have gone another way. And
like that day, maybe?
That day, yeah. That's probably one that sticks with me.
That's one of them, possibly.
Yeah. But I can't remember thinking that it was because I was white that I was lucky. It's
there's always so many factors at any given time, right?
So many, yeah. I'm going to think about that one.
I mean, there was I know a couple of people who used to go to a refugee camp on the other side of the border from Guatemala in Mexico. And basically, whenever they were there, the white Canadians were there, the Guatemalan military never fired into the refugee camp.
Ah.
But when they were gone, that's when that would happen.
Well, when I was walking around San Salvador, I had a gold chain. Someone came up and snapped it off my neck. Probably because I was white.
Some combination of you being white and the chain being gold.
Right, exactly. That was a shock, you know.
Yeah, they probably needed that gold chain.
They probably did. And I probably would have given it to them.
Yeah, it would have been a little easier if they just asked, right?
Oh, well.
So despite the fact that the book isn't actually fully funded yet, you are actually making plans for a book tour, or more just visiting friends and family?
Probably in the fall. I mean, the book is designed. We're just now editing the text. And the text, by the way, part of it's written by Joanna Fernandez, who wrote a book recently about the Young Lords Party called, she's a historian. She called, it's called The Young Lords, A Radical History. And she also edited Writing on the Wall, the selected prison writings of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So she did this extensive interview and contextualized my life a lot. You know, like I told her that my dad had been in jail when I was born and for selling tires on the black market. And she said, oh, well, that was part of the rationing law, you know. And I had never thought about what law it was that put him into, you know, so.
Because rubber was rationed for the war. Right.
Right. And a wonderful artist named William Cordova, who's the first person who really called attention to my photos. He lives in Miami most of the time. He's Peruvian American. And he bought about 10 of my photos early on, like in 27, right after I started putting them on Facebook. And became kind of a champion of my work, you know, because he has work at the Whitney, you know, permanent collection stuff. He just got at Guggenheim, great, you know. So he wrote this piece that, you know, sure made me feel good, you know.
Yeah, that's always nice.
It's more than that. He's been just so generous. You know, that's the thing I found when I started to digitize the photos and put them on Facebook. I got so many offers of help from people, you know, to show me how to do this, to give me connections for that, to, like, you know, encourage me and things. I was overwhelmed by it. I'm a bit overwhelmed by being referred to as an artist, because that's kind of never how I looked at myself, you know. I still don't. I still call myself a cultural worker.
It's a political distinction there, really. Not necessarily an artistic distinction, but right?
Right, right.
Whether we're artists or cultural workers, it's up to other people to decide, right? I mean,
I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah.
I'll be whatever you want.
I'll be whatever too. But I like cultural worker. I identify more with that, but I'll accept the accusation of artist when leveled. Yeah.
I'd also like to mention that my publisher is called Osmos, and a woman who's representing me, K. Sophie Rabinowitz, is, you know, the person who's editing the book that's coming out. So it's coming out through Osmos, and they've exhibited my photos and probably will again at some point, and help with the tour and the so you could. Contact them, actually, if you're interested in prints, you can,
or booking a stop on the tour, perhaps.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And they're reachable at osmos.address@gmail.com.
Osmos is like osmosis.
Yeah, OSMOS, all caps.
Excellent.
So,
Bev, it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, I want to see your kids when I come. And maybe
they're not in the room. I think their mom took them out. But you can see them in person instead of behind the curtain. Yeah.
Well, the Laurel Park. I mean, I remember that park.
Oh, yeah. Meet you there. Yeah. Great. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for everybody for joining this discussion with Bev Grant. Check out bevgrantphotography.com and check out her amazing photos and amazing music. But the photos are coming out in book form sometime soon. And you can find look for Bev Grant on GoFundMe for that as well, for the GoFundMe for the book project. And thanks for tuning in. You can hear this in video form if you go to youtube.com/drovix. It's archived there, and in it'll be up soon in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, don't pay the rent unless you really have to. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.